This is a Glassbox Media podcast.
This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than their worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to The Blank Podcast, the podcast where we talk to well-known people about their lives, their careers, and navigating those difficult moments along the way. I'm Giles Paley-Phillips, and with me is my co-host, co-pilot, co-producer, co-friend, Jim Daly. Co-Palace supporting friend.
Co-Palace, no, that should have been top of the list, really. Co-Palace, which comes up in the podcast today. I won't spoil it, but it does come up. Co-friend. Sounds like sort of half a friend. Like I sort of friend when I can.
Well, it's like we co-friend someone else almost, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, that's what it sounds like. Yeah, it's like, you know, in Italian football, they have these weird contracts where you can co-own a player, can't you? Like Inter and Brescia can both co-own. Who does he? I don't know who he plays for. In that, is like one week, one the other. I don't really get it, but that's what it sounded like to me. Like,
well, I guess we co-own the podcast. Maybe we're co-owners.
That makes us more sound like we own a football club. We are the co-owners, and the fans are just not happy. You know, there's protests every week.
They're sending us messages.
Exactly. Yeah, they want us out of their club. Get out of my club. But anyway, to answer your question, I'm doing great, thank you.
That's
how
good
are you?
To hear. I'm very well, thank you. Yes, enjoying some sunshine. It's now starting to come out more.
Indeed. So, what are we, mid February, mid to late February, actually. Yeah, yes. Oh, we're so close to spring, because March is spring, basically, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, it's sunny here as well, so that's, something about sunshine just makes you sort of breathe a bit more, doesn't it? It just makes you feel, you can breathe a bit.
Well, you feel more inclined to go outside as well.
Well, exactly. So you get more fresh air. I'm going to start running. I'm going to start running again now. I need to start doing that. I was about to mention my personal trainer, Sam, who is a good mate, had a horrific accident this week. I'm not going to tell you what it is because it was really gruesome, but he doesn't listen to the podcast. But shout out to Sam. I hope you're feeling better, mate, and recovering, because it's pretty nasty. Anyway, I'm going to go running again now that it's sunny. It's better in the summer and spring running. Winter running is
it's
rubbish.
When this episode goes out, because obviously we record in advance, I'll be doing a very, very long walk. Doing a walk for three amazing charities, ActionAid, the Dementia Choir, and Shout 85258. I'm walking from East Croydon.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Back to Seaford. 8.8 miles. So I'm going to do in one day.
Whoa. So how long is that going to take? Like and a whole day?
It's going to take about 20 hours, I think.
Whoa. That is an undertaking, mate. Ooh,
I know. I kind of regret sort of saying I'd do it.
Here we are. It's got your face. Here we are. You are Giles Paley-Phillips too, for some reason.
Okay, well, yeah.
Or is this an old one? Hang on. Oh, no. You've raised 1,200 quid already. That's amazing.
Yeah, well, I've been, some very generous people have been been helping.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Okay. So it is. Hang on. Let me just double check. So I can't believe there's another Giles. There's a number one Giles Paley Phillips out there. That's mad.
Yeah.
It is justgiving.com/crowdfunding/ Giles-Paley-Phillips-2.
Okay, so
but if you do what I did and just Google Giles Paley Phillips Just Giving, it's actually the top link. You could just do
that. Thank you. Thank you for
look at your social accounts as well, because I'm sure you're tweeting it out.
Go on Twitter and stuff. And actually, lots of lovely people have been sharing and stuff. So that's nice.
So when are you doing this?
This will be the 23rd of February, which will be the day after this episode comes out.
I feel so. Hang on, are we recording an episode soon after you? Well, we're recording one 2 days later, won't we?
Yeah, so hopefully I will have recovered.
We'll see what sort of shape you're in.
I might be doing it in bed with lots of blister plasters on my feet.
Yes. So, yeah, definitely, as someone that has done long walks for the Palace for Life Foundation every year, blister pads, take as many as you physically fit in your bag. Take loads of snacks. That's the thing you think, like, get like loads of like Graze bars and stuff. And a good podcast.
Several podcasts. I'm looking at places along the route to stop and eat copious amounts of food. So it's going to be a little jolly by myself. And actually, if anyone's on that route, I mean, go on my social media. I've posted the route. You can come and join me. I'm happy to have some company along the route.
That's so, a great idea. People could come and do little like walking legs.
I've got a couple of people I think that said they want to come and join me. So yeah, please do come and join me. But equally, I'm happy to do it on my own and listen to podcasts.
I think you want a blend. You want a little blend of like bit of solitude. You can listen to a pod and crack on. And then I think now and then you'll need a bit of like human company to help you do it. So if any of our listeners do live along that route, definitely get out and, you know, even if it's a 10-minute walk with Giles.
Absolutely.
Go and give him some company, because I think that will definitely spur you on, to complete.
And I'll probably do some like Instagram and Twitter lives.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And we'll make sure we sort of retweet those and stuff on
anyway,
and,
enough about me.
No, that's great. That's great. I can't wait to see you the day after.
I'll be wrecked. Absolutely wrecked.
Oh, man.
But anyway, she's good. And it's for some very, very, very important charities. So I'm very happy to help them. This is my way of being able to help. And they do incredible work. So please do support. But let's move on to our brilliant guest this week. We've got, it's an amazing episode.
Yeah.
With the brilliant Nova Reed, who is a writer and activist. She's an anti-racist campaigner, and she's got a brilliant book out called The Good Ally, which we talk about in some depth, but we talk about her journey into where she is now as a campaigner. And it's just such a brilliant conversation, and we're not going to have a special Patreon version of this week. We're going to give you everything, because
there's still a patron version. Patrons will still get a version, but it'll just be the same as everyone else, because we think that there's a lot of important information in this, and it needs to be sort of out there for everyone. Patrons will still get it a day early, and we'll still get the advert free version, so you're still getting an incentive. But there's just, Nova's doing incredible work, and she's a very important person, and she talks, you know, a lot of what she does is driven from personal traumatic experiences, and we talk about that. And she's very open on this episode, as she is in a lot of her work as well. But she's just a fabulous person. And this is an episode, you know, if you're sort of like looking at the blurb of this and you're thinking, well, I'm not racist, so obviously I oppose racism, which I'm sure all our listeners do. That's not what this is about. This is about actually finding out what you can do to genuinely help, because all of us, having been brought up wherever we've been brought up, most countries in the world probably we're brought up in a country that has a sort of systemic racist sort of institution, which unfortunately the UK does. So you will still be a part of that, but you can help. You know, the whole, this is a positive episode about you can help, you can change, you can develop as a person, and you can help marginalized communities by doing that. So it's a really powerful episode, and I hope, you know, I found a lot of takeaways from it. I've literally ordered her book just now as well, because I think I want to read that as well. So and I hope our listeners get as much as we did from talking to Nova.
It was great. And there was a thing right near the end of the conversation where we talked about collective healing, and that's a very important thing. It has to be a collective. We all need to come together and fight racism together. You know,
absolutely,
and it's a lovely phrase that she'd come up with, and it's collective healing, and like she said, this book is for the change makers, and we are all the change makers.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a wonderful conversation with her, and very privileged to have her on the podcast.
Absolutely. And we can all be change makers, even if you think maybe you're someone that can't, you can be. And she explains how on this episode. So before we delve in, though, let's read out a tweet from one of our listeners, as we do normally at the top of the show. I've got one here from Catherine Keane. One of our patrons as well. Just a fantastic person and a long-time supporter. And this is off the back of the Tim Downey episode. Now, Tim's episode has gone down brilliantly. We've had so much response to it.
People are loving Tim.
People love Tim, and they've loved his episode. I mean, he's a lovable guy, so I'm not surprised by that at all. And Catherine says, excellent episode, and a fellow dyslexic. I love Tim's passion for books and film. Unfortunately, I struggle with reading, so films have always been my books, but recently found Audible and discovered so many wonderful books. Jaws is my most recent. By the way, there's a wonderful Wimpy in Dorking. Well, there we go. Wimpy's still alive and well in Surrey, and actually my sister and brother-in-law live in Dorking. So when I go and visit them, I might pop into Wimpy and have a taste of the 80s. So thank you, Catherine, for that tweet.
Yeah, absolutely. We got another one here from, it's called The Podcast Devotees, and they've said, an absolutely amazing listen. Do let us know what you think. So that's like a dedicated podcast lovers Twitter account there. But I've also got some here from Tim's Instagram, and people are loving the episode on there.
Right.
I've got one here from
really good.
M. Lady Smith. And she says to Tim, you are an amazing storyteller. I could really use a good and funny story right now, and I'm enjoying the podcast. Well, if you want to get in touch with us, you can. You can get our handles.
Are you able to record yourself?
Pod, and you can talk to us on Twitter, Instagram,
and
Facebook.
That'd be great.
But I think we should delve into this week's episode, Jim. Well. It's with the wonderful Nova Reed here on the Blank Podcast.
Brilliant.
I was listening to your podcast recently, Conversations, which is brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And I was listening to the last episode, the most recent one you did, which was obviously in conjunction with your book coming out, which I'd love to talk to you a lot about on this podcast. And something that struck me, and it's something I've been talking to quite a few authors recently about, because a lot of friends of mine have had books coming out, and it's about publication anxiety. And it's something that a lot of authors that I've spoken to have talked to me about it, but it's not something they talk about publicly. And it really struck me that you talked about it quite openly on the podcast, and it really resonated with me, because I've had several books out, but it doesn't get any easier every time one comes out. And then Jim and I did a book together based on the podcast, and it was Jim's first book, so I know that he kind of probably had some of those feelings as well. But yeah, I just wanted to talk to you a bit about that, if you're happy to talk about that.
Well,
sorry,
we are diving in. I mean, publishing The Good Ally, it's a book about anti-racism, which as a black woman can be volatile. I can be in some extraordinarily hostile places and have some really provocative and violent responses. So there's kind of that at one end of it. And also it's quite autobiographical. There's so much. I mean, it makes sense, but there's so much more of me in it than I expected that I would write. But it felt honest and in integrity to share more about my own personal experiences, as I'm drawing comparisons to data and stats and all of the information that we can kind of put to one side or keep a distance from. And so it was more autobiographical than I ever intended. So I just felt incredibly vulnerable because there was so much of me there. But then there's all of the, you know, I'm a recovering perfectionist, and there's imposter syndrome, and there's, holy shit, why did I write that story? Oh my God, it's too late now. And I remember my editorial team and my publishers must have thought I was losing my mind, because I kept saying, I've had a dream and I need to take this out, and can I change this? And like, Nova, it's gone to typesetters now. Let it go. And so you're with the content, you're with the content for so long and in such an intimate way. It's just yours, and the only people that interact with it are your publishers. And even then, the way they interact with it is quite clinical. It's quite distant. They're looking at it structurally and as an editor. And so I hadn't anticipated how it would feel, thinking, wow, you're just vulnerable. You're giving yourself to the world for people to judge it, love it, loathe it, tear it apart, and you have to surrender. And so the weeks running up to my book launch, I remember getting in touch with my herbalist and saying, I need something to just help with my nervous system is so activated. Can you help? And we were talking on the phone at the time, and she said, Nova, are you pacing around? And I said, yeah, I had so much nervous energy and I was just finding it really difficult to settle. So I wasn't sleeping very well either. So I found that incredibly intense. And it wasn't until after my book launch, I did a book launch event myself, and the first major pieces of press coming out, that I started to be able to just settle and like, okay, it's out there now. Surrender.
Yeah, I think you're right about surrendering. I'm definitely someone that nervous paces. I remember before exams at school, I'd be pacing up and down like the common room and just wouldn't be able to sit still. I don't know if that's just something about getting that nervous energy out somehow.
Yeah,
and that's the way
of
doing
it. Yeah.
I used to find that very difficult. And I think you're right about sort of like, I'm not an experienced book writer. The blank book was my first one, and didn't really know what I was doing. I'll just try this and like see if they like it and see what happens. But you're right, like you do have to sort of you do sort of give in to the anxiety, but you do have to be that, being vulnerable and being open. You do have to sort of bury into it a little bit. And I remember doing the audio, we were lucky enough to then get an audiobook deal off the back of that, so we were recording the audiobook, and I remember reading it thinking, what did I include that? I said that, did I? Why? I don't remember that. I've been a bit personal here. I'm not even sure anyone, one, cares, or two, wants me to be that vulnerable, I guess. But I think you sort of have to be. I think if you're talking about personal matter, then you have to, don't you? Otherwise, it's not as real. Does that make sense?
It does. But then I learned that there's the difference between writing about something that's personal and then reading it out loud in the recording studio. I didn't consider this.
Exactly.
It's funny enough, totally. And that was another thing you sort of touched on in the podcast. It was something that Jim and I were kind of offered for someone else to read it, like an actor, and we said no, we want to do it ourselves. And when I was in there, I found it incredibly stressful, actually, I have to say. I'm not as you might tell during this podcast, I'm not a trained broadcaster, and I found it really difficult. And I think actually going back over some very personal things like Jim said was hard as well. And I can imagine, you know, for you with your book, there's a lot of, you know, raw moments in there, and painful moments, which you're having to say out loud, which is a totally different experience to writing it down.
Totally different. And again, you know, it's my first experience. I have nothing to compare it to. And I didn't anticipate how hard it would be. I remember in the recording studio, we were reading chapter 7, which was one of my hardest chapters to write. And I end it on a very personal experience of shame that I had. And I don't know how many times we had to record that section, because I just, like I said to them, like, I don't mind, like, keep the emotion in. It's real. It's human. Don't edit that out, because they want the cleanliness as well. I'm like, no. I don't mind that. But I couldn't get the words out, and I, you know, voice kept cracking. And at one point I had to leave the room, and I just had to, it was very difficult. And so, there's an added layer.
Do you think that if you're, obviously it's very personal material, but you think if someone listening to it or reading it can feel that emotion and connect to it, well, then you've done a good job, haven't you? Because if you can make someone feel that, because good art, content, that kind of thing, it's not necessarily about reading it or listening to it, it's about feeling it inside. And we all know that we've all read a book or listened to a piece of music or audiobook where we've really felt it. So you almost have to go that deep so that people reading it can connect to it and feel it in the same way.
Absolutely.
How does some free wine sound? After a January that definitely lasted longer than scheduled, and with Mother's Day creeping up on us around the corner, it's the perfect time to try your new favourite wine club, Wine 52, for free. That's right. All you got to do is go to www.wine52.com/blank and cover the postage costs of $5.95 and you'll get 3 bottles delivered to you. Now, Wine 52 is a discovery club all about showcasing the very best wine from a different region each and every month. This month is the rightfully revered region of Bordeaux, which features a rich, gorgeous Bergerac from Fabien Castaing, as well as a crisp and zesty Sauvignon Blanc from the award-winning Bordeaux families. How are my French accents there? Not great. I actually have some with me here in front of me, so I'm going to give it a little taste right now. There we go. That is very nice indeed. That was the Bergerac that I was trying then, and I'm going to go in for another. Do you know what? I'll wait till the end of the advert. If you have a preference on type, Wine 52 have you covered, as you have the choice of a mix, red-only or white-only case. Also included is Glug magazine, which is a great name, which delves into each region's wine culture, and 2 tasty snacks as well. After your free case, you'll join the monthly wine club, but there's no minimum commitment, and if it's not for you, you can pause or cancel at any time. So remember, that's www.wine52.com, that's the word wine and the numbers 52.com/blank to claim your free case today.
Sorry to sort of deep it go so deep.
We've gone
so
early.
Yeah, we have. Yeah, I know. It's like, bloody hell. All right, we're going. No, I like it. It's honest.
Let's dial it back a little bit. You grew up in Hertfordshire.
I did.
Very leafy kind of Hertfordshire. And what was growing up there like? What was it like for you?
For the most part, it depends. I loved living there. I had a great experience. My family, we're all very close. But I guess it was tinged with racism, and yeah. I knew that obviously the colour of my skin was brown, but I didn't know I was black and racialised as black and other until I was about 7 or 8 years old. And then from that moment, I really, really struggled with my identity and belonging and feeling like, and learning that my value as a human being was less. And so, you know, it was complicated at times, and that continued to when I was at senior school and started to really experience racism there. So yeah, it's home, and it's also not home.
Yeah, that must be a difficult sort of mixed feeling to have, because you don't, you know, as kids we don't choose our homes. You know, our parents are there and they bring us up, and we didn't ask to be there, and yet so you're sort of put in this environment and this situation you didn't really ask for, and as kids you sort of then asked to sort of navigate it as best you can, and you obviously had some horrible experiences. So, and yet it is still home. So it must be sort of conflicting, I guess, emotions really sort of against each other.
At times, yeah. I mean, not so much now, but certainly growing up, because I always had this feeling that I didn't belong.
Yeah.
I was always told, you know, go back to your own country. And I'm like, well, this is my country. Like, yeah. What would you mean by that? And as you get older and you understand more about what racism is, you're like, well, I don't, like, what am I, where I always was battling with that feeling of not belonging as I was growing up into adulthood, for sure.
Yeah, and I think as a young person, people would battle with identity anyway. But for you to then have the added layer of the racism on top of it just makes that battle of who you are much, much worse. You sort of had it sort of multiplied, I guess.
Yeah, it's the compounding. We talk about discrimination now, and like, depending on who you are and where you are, that can be compounded as a, you know, discrimination as a woman, discrimination as a black woman, and then, you know, sexuality and disability, all of these things they add to your experience of social suffering.
And I'm right in thinking early on in your sort of working career, you were in, did performance, like you were an actor and stuff. Was that something that you did early on in your school life?
Well, it wasn't like that was the goal, Giles. I was supposed to be an actress. I'm like, how the hell have I ended up here? That was what was always my dream. And so I studied at an institution called London Studio Centre, who actually probably are more known for professional dancers, but they have lots of arms. So I went through the musical theatre arm and I worked in theatre for a little while. But that was when I really started to understand systemic racism, I guess. Like, I would be, the number of auditions I would be put forward to were really limited, and it was only black roles, and I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, I can play any role. Like, why am I being put in a box because of the color of my skin? And I remember I had a acting teacher who would say, well, Nova, darling, you're never going to play that role, you're black, darling. And oh, so I God. Was I started to learn about I started to see my peers' careers advancing because they would just had more access to opportunity than I did in the boxes that I was being placed in. And so, you know, that environment is hard anyway, but it corrodes your confidence. And I ended up, I had an injury as well. And so combination of that and injury, I was done. And I couldn't find a way to make a sustainable career and also play something beyond a black person who was either a service worker, impoverished, or in some kind of gang. Like, that was the limitations, and I felt really frustrated by that.
Yeah, my wife is an actor as well, and I am a comedian who gets offered not many advert castings, but you see scripts come in, and I think there's still a problem with sort of systemic racism in the performing industry.
Oh,
because you
is.
See scripts come in and it'll say something like young black man 40s that athletic, and then you read the script, you think, this is not, or the dialogue, this has not been written by a black person.
Yeah.
And you think, how can they try to be authentic in this moment? It's clearly you can tell always who's written the script sometimes by the way it's written. This has been written by an old white guy in an office somewhere, and this is now, this is 2022, and so you're still finding those limitations, and that essentially that sort of built-in racism in the industry even now.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's why you see like British actors going and finding their fame in America, like Cynthia Erivo is a colleague of mine, and she is doing exponentially well in the United States. And like, there's Daniel Coulier, obviously Idris Elba. There's so much who did not get the breakthrough that they deserved and were talented enough to get here, and then went to the States, and then suddenly the British acting industry then wants to claim them. And and that's, you know, there are names that I don't know of and that have had to do that and have been able to do that, because we're not all able, we don't all have the means to do that and take that risk and try and establish a career in a country that's not your own. But yeah, still the same, I'm still a member of Equity, the acting union. Yeah. And so I can see what's going on. And there are still things that I were struggling with when I was back then about not even having basic makeup artists backstage with makeup for my skin tone. And still they're like, well, this is still an issue. And so they were putting a call out to do some training. I'm like, why is that not a foundational part of training to learn how to do stage makeup on every single palette? Like, we're not aliens.
Was that... Yeah. Exactly. And is that because decisions from the top? Because I kind of equate it to football sometimes. Like, people say in football, well, there's not enough black referees, there's not enough black managers, not enough black coaches. And it's like, well, yeah, because the people making decisions at the top of the game are not black. They are still boardrooms full of white people, the top of the referees union, top of the FA. And so, of course, and when then clubs and lower league down say, well, we are equal opportunity clubs and stuff, you think, well, yeah, but the system isn't. Like, you might be trying to be at that level, but actually, if you haven't got someone at the top of the referees union who is black and is helping young black referees come through, I can only imagine the abuse that young black referees would get at the lower levels, then of course you're not going to have a pathway for them to get to the very top. And so, and I imagine it's the same thing in the performing industry.
Yeah, it's the same. And, you know, representation is important, but it's not the only thing. And you know, sometimes if we don't have, you know, we need to be asking ourselves, like, wherever we hold societal advantage, especially when you have power over other people in terms of career, is, well, what am I missing here? What don't I know? What expertise can I bring in? Who do I need to talk to? There's always ways that, even if we don't belong to whatever the marginalized group is, if we don't have that representation, right, how can I outsource and bring that in? Or who can I speak to? What focus groups can I be doing? And, you know, it's not like these social issues aren't spoken about now in mainstream. There should be no excuse for us to be thinking about, well, actually, why is everyone around us all look the same? And what more can we be doing to bring more talent in that's representative of the world that we live around? And why are we only commissioning plays that are written by white writers? Like, what white, straight, able-bodied writers, like, yeah. How many stories could we be telling if we go outside of that pool? So you have to have the desire to be thinking, what am I missing here? What expertise can I draw in? How can I, where can I do better? And if that curiosity is not there, then that's why we end up with these homogenous groups.
Did you think it's a pride thing? Because I'm sure that people in various positions of power, you might be someone at the top of an institution, you might be someone in the middle or whatever, wherever industry. And I'm sure most people think, well, I'm not racist. Like, you know, I'm an open-minded sort of person. And so if someone says, yeah, but actually, if you look at your institution, you know, in terms of your employment figures, your diversity figures actually maybe very low, that people think, oh, sorry, what, you're calling me racist? Rather than thinking, that's a fair point. I need to address that. I need to, oh, okay, right, who can I ask that can help me sort of progress that? And I wonder if it's just a pride thing that stops good-hearted normal people from actually making a step towards change because they suddenly feel like people are calling them racist.
It's two things. It's pride and ego, and it is a genuine lack of understanding of what racism is beyond an overt act of hate. And I often say this because it lands for people. When I or other people who are black or other people of colour or activists talk about racists or racism or what you did or just said there is racist, what many people hear is, you are a right-wing extremist.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's not what we're saying, but that's what's heard. And so, of course, they're not that, and so they want to defend their position. Ego is not happy at all, and I need to manage perception. And then instead of, well, actually, what you did or said there is racist, and we all have the capacity to do or say racist things. But because we're not interested in receiving that feedback, oh my gosh, yeah, like you say, that's the point. Or I didn't know that. I don't understand. Help me better understand more. We just go round and round in circles and we don't progress. Yeah. So for me, it's helping people understand and having them listen and receive that the racism that I and other educators are talking about is beyond an overt act of hate. The overt stuff is easy to call out and recognise.
Yeah. Mm.
The systemic stuff is less so. But you've got to be willing to accept that It's not a good or bad binary. We all have the capacity to do or say racist things. We've been socialized in a racist society, and you know, Britain in itself has got its wealth off the back of centuries and centuries of enslavement. So, like, that's just where we are. Like, it's a tough history to reconcile, but it's our history.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's very powerful in those moments to say, I'm sorry. Help me. And I think people think, going back to vulnerability earlier, that it makes people feel vulnerable. And I know that feeling vulnerable can make people feel very uncomfortable. But actually, it's very powerful to say, I'm sorry about that.
Yeah.
What can I do to do better? Please help me. And then and then you're going down a collaborative route. And as humans, we like being collaborative. Everyone kind of wins.
It's like when we're designed to be in community and to connect with one another, and you know racism, any other ism, does the opposite of that. It disconnects us from the core part of our humanity, and it does take vulnerability and I think a lot of humility and accountability, which isn't often role modeled by adults in society, especially with current government.
100% agree.
Yeah, let's not get into that.
Sorry.
So obviously that was a you said that was that kind of a wake-up call for you, you know, that having that experience, being more aware of what was happening within an industry which you were obviously very, very excited about being involved in.
Mm.
That must have been hard as well for you to sort of take that on and learn and be learning that.
It was hard because, I mean, there were barely, I think there were, I'm just counting in my head, there were three black women and one mixed black guy in my entire year at performing arts school. And that the year group was probably around 300.
Oh, wow.
So it was so visible how, you know, we weren't there. And all of us, I think all but one of us were there on scholarship. Because again, going to these performing arts schools to be in West End or to be in film, the cost of them is outrageous. It's very elitist. Right. So we were all there on scholarship. So there's, and again, there's another access barrier there.
Yeah.
And so we were all talented enough to be working professionals in that industry. And so it was hard. And I remember when I decided to stop, and I just felt like I lost my identity. Well, who am I now? Like, I've always had this dream to be on stage and to do these, and I did do some stage work and film, but you know, I wanted a career and it was just not sustainable for me, under what I was navigating and what other black folk were navigating with so few roles.
Do you think that's changed and do you still?
No.
Silly question, really, wasn't it? That's a terrible question.
I don't, not to any extent that is sustainable. No,
because I was going to say, is that dream still there for you? Is that desire then to be back on stage still there?
I mean, I'm still on stage, but it's just in a different format.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
I got to be at the National Theatre with David Harewood in October, which was incredible. And so I did a TED talk. So I am fulfilled in that way. What I'm more interested in that I haven't really spoken about is screenwriting. And so, you know, using my gift as a writer to change the narrative of some of the scripts that are going out. So that's a little dreaming.
Yes. Well, that's
behind
a difference.
The scenes.
Yeah, so that when you get those scripts and it's for a black actor, you think, this has been written back.
There we
finally
go.
Yeah. This or actually like makes sense.
Yeah, and you know, directing I've done a little bit of as well in the past and I really enjoy that as well. So there are other ways, and also directors and writers get more respect than actors, which is, you know, it should be across the board, but there is more respect.
I've seen that. Again, I'm just a comedian trying to do adverts to get money. But that's right, any comedian does adverts. Most of the scripts are absolutely awful, and but you are treated like I don't know, like a number, essentially, because the number of times scripts come in and they say, can you turn this around for tomorrow, and you think, I've got a life. I'm a dad. I've got a kid. Yeah. I've got things to do. Or you'll get it on a Friday and say, can you do this Monday morning? Do they think like actors don't do anything on weekends?
I couldn't bear that. I used to get really irate by that as well. But it was just, it felt very like you're a little rag doll.
Yeah.
Mm.
And it's like you should be appreciated. You should be thankful.
You'd be grateful.
You sent me this script. What this awful script for some? I had one for some Ukrainian fast food thing. No, Ukrainian power drink. It was like Power Horse or something. Oh, it was just. I would have got to go to Ukraine to film that. That would have been cool. But I didn't get it anyway.
It does make you think that the writer had to turn it around in 24 hours as well, maybe.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. It's often the creative people, I think, isn't it, that sort of don't get treated particularly well. But then if
Correct.
You get people in more influential powers, like directors and producers and stuff, that actually understand that and can treat actors like people.
Exactly.
Then maybe that's can change even a little bit.
Exactly.
This episode of the Blank Podcast is sponsored by Harry's. Harry's is way more than a razor company.
They're here to revamp your whole routine.
From close shaves and flake-free hair, all the way to clear, healthy skin.
Harry's helps guys feel good.
And they are offering our listeners a free travel-size shower gel with a trial set. What's in the trial set, Charles?
There's loads of stuff in the trial set, Jim. Each razor comes with an expertly engineered weighted handle.
Yep, It comes with a 1.5-blade cartridge crafted by artisans in their German factory, complete with precision trimmer.
A handy foaming shave gel for effective lubrication.
A travel blade cover for life's adventures.
And free shower gel for our listeners.
You've tried the shower gel, haven't you, Giles?
I have. It's very lovely. It's got a lovely scent to it. And yeah, it was really great. I felt very clean afterwards.
And I have to say, I've been using Harry's, the actual razors, for about a year, actually. And they've completely changed how my shaving experience. I used to be someone that was like, didn't really like wet shaves because it would, I'd get little nicks and stuff and it wouldn't be that comfortable. And the Harry's razors are really, really smooth. I never get nicks anymore. And it's actually made shaving an enjoyable experience. So I can 100% recommend it from my face to yours. Here's some facts about Harry's. Their shower gels, face wash and skincare products can be added to shave plans anytime, anywhere.
Cleansing and exfoliating before you shave increases the chance of cleaner results.
And their products are formulated with 0% sulfates, parabens or dyes and are alcohol-free. So no nasties there, Giles.
No. Make sure you support the podcast and give your own shower shave a go by redeeming a free Harry's trial set. All you cover is $3.95 for delivery.
Just head to harrys.com/blank to have your set delivered and start a shave plan. Your freebie will be added at checkout.
That's harrys.com/blank. I'm going to leap ahead a little bit. You started a thing called New Bride, which was a web site.
Well, I mean,
essentially,
it's no longer trading anymore. But it was. It started as a wedding blog when blogging was in. So that goes to show how long ago that was.
Yeah.
And then it kind of morphed into a wedding show, which it did incredibly well. And alongside that, I would do consultancy. So the blog was developed out of my own wedding engagement. I got engaged and I was looking for inspiration for our wedding. And there was just no representation of black couples at all. I remember there were so many things that led up to it. Like, so the magazines were first, 300 plus pages of zero people who looked like me and my husband. And then you would go to wedding venues to view if you would like to book the venue for your wedding day, and then they'd give you these brochures and they'd be selling the dream to you, flick through the brochures and again there was nobody in them that looked like me. And you go to wedding shows where you might connect with suppliers or buy bits and pieces, and there was the expectation that my husband and I couldn't afford the services that were on offer, so there was all of that kind of nonsense and casual racism going on. And I was like, this is ridiculous. Like, love is something that is so universal. And it was just, if you're not white, heterosexual and a Cinderella type, you weren't included. So I created a platform that challenged that and also represented couples that were often ignored. That did really well. And as a result of that, lots of brands, hotels, creative agencies started to contact me and say, wow, you've got such a diverse pool of readers, like how do we tap into that? And so then I started to do workshops and consultancy, I guess, before workshops. And because to me it was like common sense, like, why are you not doing this already?
Yeah.
It was common sense. And then that just built and built, and I did more and more consultancy, and then that developed more into training. And then I just noticed that obviously, I'm a black woman. I'm going to bring race and my experiences of racism into narratives that I have, because I can't separate my race from my identity.
Yeah.
And every time I brought race up, there was just so much awkwardness and shame and embarrassment. I'm like, what is this? And so that then led me to really lean into just doing workshops on race, inclusion, and then more specifically anti-racism, which kind of led more to the work that I'm doing now. So it was born out of my own wedding and frustration at not being represented again that I created my own platform, and that resonated with other human beings and other brands.
It's often the best ideas are common sense, where you think, I can't believe someone hasn't done this already.
It was so obvious. And even now, like when I decided to, so I'd always been moving away from New Bride, probably, if I'm honest, since the end of 2019, because I was just doing more and more around anti-racism, and it felt, the wedding industry felt very frivolous, and that I could only kind of stay on the surface, and I wanted to go deeper and wider, and I felt too constrained. And so, by the time of summer 2020, Black Square Summer, as some of my colleagues call it, and this global spotlight on racial justice, it was a natural opportunity for me to say, this is it, I'm done, and this is what I'm doing now, come and follow me over here. And also, I think I announced I had a book deal then as well, so it was a natural transition for me. But so many people said, Nova, you just left a gaping hole in the industry. And I, you know, I thought about selling, and I had some offers to buy New Bride, but they weren't right, they weren't it just felt out of integrity to sell it. So
You're saying about the wedding industry basically doesn't sort of cater for anyone that isn't white, straight, a Cinderella type. It's absolutely true. And yet there are lots of people, in fact, there are probably more people who aren't white, straight, Cinderella type. So it just seems completely bizarre.
I mean, in terms of money, I can't remember the data now because it's been a while I've been in the data in an intense way there. But there were so many studies that show Black and Asian, well, African and South Asian couples, the average spend of a wedding is like double or triple that of white couples. And of course, because generally speaking, to be stereotypical, we have bigger celebrations. There's more people at our weddings.
Right,
You didn't make any business sense either. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's mad.
Yeah. So frustrating that yeah.
But it's institutional. It's institutional.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's because it's like, well, this is the way we've always done things.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And even for my husband, who, you know, he loves to take care of his appearance. Like he cares about what he looks like. There was just nothing. It was just, there was nothing for him. Like, well, what about, like, I'm invested in this as well. Like, it was all very geared towards the woman. And I'm like, what is this? It's like, it doesn't make sense.
Well, that then taps into another, I guess, sort of traditionalism that men don't want to look after themselves, which is absolutely not true. At all. But again, I just think industry is just like, well, no. Sorry, but men don't want this, so we're not going to bother. Or this is the way we do things, and we're going to just stick to this. Whereas actually, it's a lot bolder and actually just more sensible to go against the grain and not do that. But I I'm not a business person, so I don't.
It's just common sense, Jim.
I agree. It is. I mean, I see it in football as well sometimes. Some of the decisions that are made in football, and it is, as in sort of in the game. My mum and dad used to talk about common sense quite a lot growing up, and I wasn't sure I understood it. And when I became an adult, you're just talking about just like, what makes sense? I don't know. I'm not really sure where I'm going with this. So just it just started to make me a bit angry.
So those initial workshops you were doing, what did they kind of look like? And also, was that, I guess they were probably quite enjoyable as well, because you were able to, you know, start to impart some of your experiences and your knowledge.
Yeah, so in the early days, when I was mostly working kind of with five-star hotels or creative agencies, like there was more, there were less clinical corporate settings that I was in. So, you know, the kind of people that would be attracted to working those environments generally were fairly diverse, I guess. And so there was more of an open-mindedness, I guess, to what I was talking about. I was also back then talking about diversity and inclusion, which is much more palatable than anti-racism. And generally people were there to listen and improve their business. So, you know, they were enjoyable, and they looked, it depended what the client needed. I never did this package thing. I've always worked in that way because I used to coach as well. I have some background in therapy. So to me, it's all about what does the individual need? Yeah. And then I will adapt based on what their need is. And so it varied depending on what people needed. But I genuinely would help people understand definitions, concepts, and then talk about what the barriers are in their business. We would do a little bit of role play. I used to act, so I bring role play in a lot about, you know, having courageous conversations. And so it really, really varied. And I would give people ideas about, okay, if you're not attracting this demographic, let's figure out who is this demographic reading? Where are they hanging out? Like, you know, getting to help people understand what questions they can be asking or where they can be researching to know who their client is or who the client that they want to reach is. I would do those kind of workshops, and I was actually delivering one to a creative agency who had a shared office space at the time. So it wasn't just the creative agency in that office space, there were other businesses. And I was talking, and a woman walked through the door not long after I started, and they said, oh, we're doing a workshop today, you're more than welcome to listen in. And so she did. And then she approached me and gave me her business card. And she said, I'm a literary agent. Have you ever thought about turning your workshop into a book? And I'm like, no, who's going to read that bloody boring workshop about inclusion? And she said, think about it. And so I really didn't, I didn't love the idea at all. I was already writing. As a natural move from somebody who was blogging, I would often get asked to write for magazines, Refinery29, Metro's. I was already doing journalistic writing. So writing was something that was within me. And, but I'd never considered a book. I say that whilst I was playing around with writing a fiction book, just playing, I wasn't doing anything with it. I was just creative expression. And then I kind of left it for quite some time, and then I just decided to try. And she said, send me 3 chapters and then let's see, because obviously she doesn't know what my writing skills are like for nonfiction. And I sent it to her, and she almost responded immediately. I think it was within 24 hours. And she said, this is extraordinary. We need to meet. I think I can get you a book deal. And I'm like, oh.
I wasn't expecting that.
I wasn't. And if I'm honest, I didn't really believe her. And I remember her saying, Nova, I wouldn't take on an author that I didn't think I'd get a book deal. Like, I'm an agent. Like, that's my job.
Yeah.
And so we started writing and working together at the end of 2018. We started submitting in 2019. Got some initial interest from some big publishers. It wasn't quite right. And so I needed to go back and do some tweaking. Got lots of rejections along the way. Mm-hmm. At one point, I was like, I've had enough. I'm not doing it now. I'm done. It's taken up too much time and we're not getting anywhere. And then early 2020, she submitted it again. And I got some beautiful feedback from HarperCollins, who are my now publisher. And they said something really interesting. They said, we love it, but I feel like Nova's writing to two different audiences. If she can integrate, and because what I had originally done in my book was write a corporate book. So it's very much about my workshop. So I'm talking to a corporate audience, and generally speaking with a corporate audience, people are at different stages of understanding. So it's more general. I'm having to do a bit of convincing and it's quite light touch. Whereas if I'm talking to an individual change maker who's socially conscious, who wants to do better, raise socially conscious kids, contribute, be a good human, I can go deeper and wider. And so I was kind of doing both. And it wasn't until I got that feedback from HarperCollins that I realized, I was like, ah. And so then we shifted, and it was for the individual change maker. And that was The Good Ally. And that was the book that got a deal. So that's how that happened.
But that is you being open to feedback. It goes back to what we were saying earlier in the podcast. That is you being open to that and being like, okay, yeah, I can change this. I can try this. And because without that, book deal wouldn't have happened. And without that, change doesn't happen.
And also, it was more me. Like, I didn't have the awareness to see what I was doing in my writing. And then when she said that in the way that she said it, I was like, it unlocked something in me. So I wasn't editing I was not censoring myself. I was writing as me.
And how did it feel sort of getting that?
Because it's almost sort of validation, isn't it? Like, I know you weren't expecting it or sort of looking for it, but having that agent, literary agent, say, I think I can work with you, and then say, this is really good stuff, that must have been a new kind of feeling, I guess.
And also, I just sorry to interrupt, to caveat this, it often, and I say this to a lot of authors who ask me about getting published, it's often harder to get an agent than it is to get a publishing deal.
Really?
Yeah, so actually to get, well, so actually, take more validation from that, because like to get someone, to get an agent interested in your work is often very hard. So just to sort of caveat that a little bit.
Yeah, and like it was, for me, it wasn't something that I was seeking. I was just doing my work, and somebody said, there is an opportunity here, when think about it. And so I did, for quite a number of months. And so in the beginning, like, I didn't believe her. I was like, yeah, okay, whatever. Yeah, all right. I've had agents before that have got me no work
in
the acting world. So it wasn't like, having an agent wasn't a new concept for me in that respect. But it was, and I will name her a name. Her name is Anwen, and her agency is Bird Literary Agency. And what I love about her, and what I've discovered with other friends who've got agents, is she develops her writers, and not all agents do that. So there was a developmental period with us, which, you know, was vital for me to be able to go beyond writing articles, if that makes sense. I could always write, but writing articles, journalistic articles, is very different to writing an entire book.
It's
a very special relationship, and it must be really hard not to have that support when you're going through the process of writing. I can't imagine not having that support.
Well, it's interesting. It's something that comes up on the podcast quite a lot about having mentors and, you know, people that are there supporting you and encouraging you. And I think the author agent relationship is a crucial one, because you need that person fighting your corner, but then also that person who's, you know, courageous enough to tell you and it's not going quite right, or it's not quite how they sort of envision it. And I think that's really important, and it is a very special relationship. And you know, it sounds like you've got a really great agent there who's obviously willing to put that time and effort into you.
And it's, you know, it's a transparent relationship as well. It's two ways. It's like, okay, I need to be able to give you feedback and stuff, and particularly with the content that I'm handling, because she's a white woman, like, I need to be able to be honest about when things aren't working, or if, you know, things are harmful, and to continue to be in relationship with one another. It's quite rare, actually, but it's important that there isn't this power dynamic that I definitely experienced when I was an actress. Ari, you should be grateful for having an agent. Well, actually, no, you're collaborating, you're co-creating.
Yeah, that's vital to make that distinction, I think. I think you're right. And I think that is in different, you know, I've got a very great lit agent, and it is more collaboration, and you work on ideas together. And
yeah,
I think that's really, really crucial. For people who haven't read the book, can you give us a kind of brief overview of what the book is about?
Yeah, so it's you know, it's called The Good Ally, and it is a guided anti-racism journey from bystander to changemaker. And essentially, I wanted to write a book that helped people understand and recognise what racism is beyond an overt act of hate. There is so much research that shows, you know, there are lots of well-meaning, well-intentioned white liberals who want to challenge racism in the world. But they're more likely to speak up about overt acts of racism than the people experiencing racism.
Yeah.
But they're less able to recognise subtle forms of racism. And we're like, oh, this this is a challenge. So how do I make people understand what it is beyond an overt act of hate? And also to have the courage to look within. Because people often say to me, well, what can I do to help? And I'm like, we've been socialised in a racist society. It is inescapable that we haven't ingested some of this stuff. And so it goes back to me, this isn't about me talking about right-wing extremists. This is about, what racist stereotypes do I hold, or what stereotypes do I hold that perpetuate racism? How am I, if I'm somebody who's in a position of influence at work, you know, how is, you know, how am I contributing to pay ethnicity pay inequity? Am I looking for that data that shows that white folk doing the same job are being paid sometimes three times more than a black person doing the same job? Like, this is how we start to look at it. Healthcare outcomes. I do a lot of work with the NHS, and around around. You know, there's often less uptake in clinical trials for medication or vaccines of people in black groups.
Yeah.
And part of the reason for that is because medical experiments historically were done on black bodies and are still are. And so there is a lack of trust and a hesitancy. And then, of course, we have COVID, and then the hesitancy to engage in vaccinations. I'm like, everything is linked. So I do a lot about taking people through the historical journey, particularly Britain's role in it, because it's often hidden or erased or not spoken about. What's happened historically? How is that still showing up today? And what can I do about it?
I can actually relate that to personal experience. I run another podcast called Five-Year Plans. It's a football podcast for Crystal Palace FC. Palace doing very well at the moment, so it's quite enjoyable. I'm sure we'll get relegated at some point. It'll be less enjoyable, but it's going okay.
My husband's old team, he was a traitor and moved to Arsenal.
Oh, no.
How can you do that?
I know.
He's even crossed the river. He's terrible. North of the river as well.
He just said, I just followed Ian Wright.
Oh, I mean, Wrighty.
Fair enough.
To be fair, Wrighty was one of our best of it. I wonder if a lot of fans did that, actually, because Wrighty was so...
He was so loved.
So good and so loved. I wonder if, it's interesting. I wonder if other people did that as well. He's a nice guy, right? I've got to work with him a few times, actually. He's a top man.
Nice.
But our podcast started off with me and three mates, and we are all straight, white, middle-class men. And for years, it was us talking about Palace. And, of course, the subject of discrimination would come up now and then because things would happen on the football pitch and stuff, and we realised it wasn't a true reflection of what was happening, because it was just, especially it wasn't a true reflection of Crystal Palace fans, because Palace are based in one of the most diverse parts of London. So we would now and then get a few tweets from people saying, guys, great discussion, but you are four white guys talking about this. And so we've tried to get a more diverse panel on. In the last couple of years, we've been able to do that. And we've got more female guests, more LGBT community guests, more people of color, and we're still trying. This is the thing, like, I'm not sitting here thinking, well, we've done it now, oh great, we've got this. We're still trying to do that, because I think it's important as a podcast for a fan base and an area of London that is diverse for us to do that as well. But that took me a long time to realize, and it took me looking inwards and going, oh yeah, no, I have, and trying. And it was hard in that moment not to be like, well the podcast is doing fine, what are you talking about? Like, actually being like, okay, yeah, we need to do something about this. And also then asking, and my mates Andy and Rob, who I'd run it with, were very good at helping, going, all right guys, what can we actually do?
Exactly.
Okay, who do we know we can talk to that's going to have a true reflection of this and understand what it's like to be a diverse fan, a Palace fan? And we're getting there. It's a work in progress, and we're getting there. But actually, as a result, the pod now is much better than it was.
Of course, because it's just like, who wants to go to the library and just read one book? Like, it adds something. I think there's a feeling that it's going to take something away. Like, having more representation is taking something from a majority group. Like, it's adding.
Yeah.
It's richer, and it has to be intentional and consistent for it to really have an impact. Yeah.
But it has to be continuous. Like, I don't think. I sometimes get very cynical with brands. Like, when you get to like Pride Month and they all change their logos to rainbows, and then 30 days later change them back, and you think, well, what was the fucking point of that? Like, or like in football, we have the Rainbow Laces campaign, and yeah, it's a great campaign to raise awareness of discrimination. But again, the players wear them for a couple of weekends a season and then go back to their like, I want to see players wearing rainbow laces season wide, because these issues don't stop at the end of the month. And so it's continuing. I do think some brands sometimes just do it as there's a phrase, isn't it? It's like, just to be, I can't remember what the phrase is, but to be seen to be doing it rather than to be actually doing something.
Well, I think it's something you talk about is that kind of performative allyship.
That's the word I'm looking for. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And performative allyship is not allyship, it's racism, because it's more about perception and ego and being seen to be doing the right thing rather than actually wanting to meaningfully address discrimination and racism, which is a form of trauma in a meaningful way. And that's, you know, it's a very clear difference when you're when you witness that as someone who's Black or even in other marginalized identities. I hear the same things. Like you know the intention behind it. You can feel it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whether this is something that's genuine and meaningful or it's not, it's ego driven.
Yeah, exactly. And it is trauma. Like I'm in your TED talk, you talked about and referenced it earlier in the podcast about being seven and a white girl saying, why does this girl look like poo? I think was the phrase she used. And like that, I can imagine. And you said, as you got older, you've suffered other forms of racism and more intentional forms of racism when this 5-year-old girl, well, you hope, didn't know what she was saying. But that is a hugely traumatic thing. And, you know, I've been through counselling and stuff. And whenever you talk about issues, it nearly always comes down to childhood. Nearly everything comes down to something you've experienced as a child. And that what you experienced then was hugely traumatic. So, of course, it's going to affect how you see yourself and affect your experience of the world. And I think people forget that. I'm glad you just said it then. Racism is a form of trauma.
People often think that it's just about name calling. Well, you know, for goodness sake, like, just crack on. And it's trauma. And, you know, there is so much research, and I talk about this in The Good Ally in great detail, and there's snippets of it in my TED talk. There is the most profound piece of research I found was that they were studying brain patterns of war veterans who'd served in some kind of war. And also, it was Black people, but African Americans specifically, and studying their brain patterns of regular exposure to racial stress. And the regular exposure to racial stress was showing up in terms of brain patterns in the same way as war veterans who've served in war as post-traumatic stress disorder.
Wow.
And I guess that is hard to digest in itself, in and of itself. But post suggests it is in the past, and it's not.
Yeah.
There is consistent, persistent, ongoing exposure to racial stress. Could that be just turning on the TV, reading headlines, walking down the street, racially profiling, or, you know, some of the more pervasive stuff that goes on at work? It's ongoing.
Yeah.
So you just think, if you don't have an opportunity to heal, and you've never had an opportunity to heal intergenerationally, you know, we're dealing with a public health issue as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I'm sorry to bring it back to football. It's literally all I know about and all I do. But there's been numerous examples, certainly in the lower leagues, of players being racially abused and referees not stopping the game, or even worse, teams then taking their players off and say, we're not dealing with this. And then that team getting fined or getting like points taken off them by the association. And it's almost like you say, like it's like referees or the FA saying, we'll just get on with it. But how can you get on with it when it's literally changed my brain signals? And you wouldn't say that to anyone that had gone through any sort of other form of PTSD or anything, or even, you know, like a leg injury or something. But if it's doing those kind of same brain signals, It's trauma still, and you wouldn't say crack on. I don't know if it's a stupid sort of British stiff upper lip spirit thing that we've all been brought up on as well, but you just wouldn't say that to anyone that was going through anything else similarly traumatic.
It's a lack of empathy, and that's a core component I talk about in my book. You know, culturally, in terms of our history with enslavement and Britain's role in it, you know, humans had to dehumanize other humans for a really long time. And we're not designed that way. Like we said, there is an intrinsic need to connect and belong and to be in community. So in order to dehumanize someone, in order to treat somebody worse, less than an animal, you have to dehumanize. Yeah. In order to dehumanize, you have to lose empathy.
Yeah.
So that is what we're dealing with as a residue of that. And so all of that I talk about and more in the book. And I really help people go on a journey to understand what it is that we're dealing with and what we can actually do to help. Because we can unlearn this stuff and we can help and do better and transform, but we have to have the courage to look and to be vulnerable and to accept what is as truth and not deny or debate it.
But we are surely born as empathetic beings. Surely that is a core nature in us. So
some of us are more predisposed to empathy than others, for sure. But we're not designed to hate.
Yeah.
We're not born with hate. We learn that pretty quick.
Yeah.
You talk about collective healing, and which is a lovely phrase, I think, actually, that idea that comes together. Yeah, no, it is. It's, I love it. And that kind of, you talked to, also, you just sort of referenced like unpicking and unlearning things. How do we start to examine our role? You know, like I'm talking, Jim and I are both middle class white guys. How do we, Jim and I, start to examine our role in this discussion, you know, and see how we can start to change our way of thinking and doing?
Yeah, I mean, it always starts with curiosity. And there's a question that in The Good Ally, I'm giving lots of prompts, like to think about this, asking questions, giving people opportunity to reflect, journal, voice note, whatever is accessible to them, but to get used to the act of self-inquiry. And part of the reason I do that is because after I was an actress, I worked in mental health for nearly 10 years. And so I've got a therapeutic training. So I'm used to being in therapy. I'm used to helping people learn how to self-inquire and be self-aware and to meet unmet needs and all of that stuff. So I'm bringing all of that in. And I ask many questions. And one of the questions I asked, and it's sometimes hard to hear, but I think it's a really good question, is how am I racist?
Yeah.
And really thinking about that. And again, it's a reminder, this isn't about overt anything. Like, how do I uphold racist stereotypes? Do I have an automatic fear response when I see a black man coming towards me? Just in terms of your podcast, Jim, that you were talking about, well, how have I perpetuated that by having four white guys on the podcast, and what can we do about it? So it could be, well, if you're a parent, what books am I buying for my children to read? And are there diverse characters within there? And am I learning about history of black people that's beyond trauma and slavery? Am I learning about the really, really great scientists and inventors and of people that contributed? Like, that's the question I'm asking. And it just gives you an opportunity to get curious. So, you know, The Good Ally guides people through that in a meaningful way. But it's about being honest. And I always say, if most of us are honest, we already know what our isms are.
Yeah.
And it's about accepting that, okay, I've learned that, and I may have caused harm in the past, or I have caused harm in the past, and I've got a beautiful opportunity to do something about that now.
Yeah, absolutely. And you do have an opportunity. It's not like you've got to a stage in your life and you think, well, I'm too old to change now. You know, I'm too racist to change now. I'm sorry, this is just me. Like, you always have an opportunity.
And it's the same, you know, the same calls that are coming across us to think about our language around ableism and like, how am I, if I'm hosting an event, one of the things I think about intentionally is, am I choosing an accessible venue so that wheelchair users can come? Do you see what I mean? It can go across also what we're doing with sexism and like, there's always something we can be thinking about. Well, how can I better include people, or who am I leaving out? Who's missing?
Yeah. So I work in the comedy industry. I try and work in the comedy industry.
You're a comedian.
Stand up.
You work in the...
Yeah. Not for a lot of money, but it still counts. And there's a comedian called Sophie Hagen, who actually, Giles, we should get on the podcast, who is absolutely fantastic and is driving for more inclusivity in the comedy industry, not just for acts, but for audiences as well. So she runs a lot of gigs that are inclusive in terms of access in venues. They are friendly gigs, so no one gets picked on in the front row.
Yeah.
They have acts that don't punch down with their material. And she's very, very good at that. And shamefully, she's one of the few acts, and I guess she's a promoter as well in that sense, that does that. And I still do a lot of gigs, or you know, I did one in Bognor Regis last Friday, which was okay. But again, as you're talking now, I'm thinking, well, actually, to get to the room, we would have to go upstairs. I have no idea if there was a lift or anything like that. And I hadn't even thought about that, because I was so nervous about emceeing and cracking on with a gig. I hadn't actually contemplated that kind of accessibility. Yeah. So there are people like Sophie who are making that change, but I guess it needs more people to do that, to change, to be honest, what is an industry that is actually does need a lot of changing.
And it's having that thought in the first place. And it's not beating yourself up. Like, there's probably many, there'll be many times where I haven't thought about things, or I could have done things better. And like, that's just the nature of being human and evolving.
Yeah.
But it is an intentional act to be anti-racist. And that includes thinking about those kinds of things as well. So, yeah.
Well, I'm going to actually, I've literally, sorry, I hope I haven't looked rude, but I'm actually Googling the book now and we're going to buy it actually as we're talking.
Okay. well, it's audio as well if you prefer listening, but yeah.
I think I prefer having it in my hands, to be honest. Something about having a book.
Old school. The old school. Like me.
There we go.
Like me.
There we go. I'm old school. No, I'm going to, yeah, definitely buy a copy because... it sounds fascinating, and I think
thank
I could
you,
use it. We're all on a journey. We're not finished products,
exactly.
And we can all still use that enhancement, I guess.
And it's designed to return to again and again. I got someone messaged me the other day. They said they've read it 3 times. I was like, it only came out in September. How have you had time?
Wow, fair play. They've raced through that.
I was like, can you put 3 reviews on?
Yeah. Keep reviewing. That's how it is. Nova, it's been such a wonderful conversation with you. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Nova. Thank you.
No, well, thank you, Nova. So, honestly, it's been a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for your time.
Giles, real pleasure. And I'm more familiar with you, Giles, than I am Jim. And I love the work that you're doing as well. So thank you for having me and inviting me. I appreciate it.
Oh, no, that's very kind of you to say.
Well, there you go. Nova Reid on the Blank podcast. I don't think we've had an episode like that before, really. And it was incredibly powerful. And she's just a brilliant, brilliant person as well. And I think actually we're sort of lucky that she's doing what she's doing. I mean, the thing about the wedding industry and that sort of no one representing for anyone that isn't white or straight, it is madness. And it is a lack of common sense as well. And it's just bizarre. And as I said before, and I'm sure she felt it as well, being in that situation where you think, why has no one else done this? Like, it's just a bit mad. So she's a pioneer in many ways as well. And it was great to talk to her. And just, it's just embracing that I have my prejudices, even if I don't try, I do because of the system I've been brought up in. How can I change it? How can I be a bit vulnerable, look inward rather than outward? And if we all do that even just a little bit, then think of the change we can all make. But it's not something you think about. We're all such busy in our lives, you don't think about it, but just taking a second to think like that, I think can make a big difference. So, thank you, Nova, for coming on. And to be honest, giving us the opportunity to think like that, because I just don't. I consider myself a very lefty, liberal, kind-hearted guy, but I have my prejudices and I don't ever stop to think about them because I'm a busy man. But being able to do that this morning, I think, was actually massively helpful.
Yeah, I think so. And kind of one of the reasons why we wanted to get her on the podcast, so we could have this frank discussion about it. And you know, I said near the end, how do we examine ourselves and the way we interact with others and behave? And how can we unpick and unlearn the things that are sort of ingrained in us through societal, through society and through, history and all these various different things that have that go into how we think about the world, and how can we unpick those and unlearn them and actually be more tolerant and more inclusive. So we've got a lot to learn, and like you say, we both consider ourselves to be, anti-racist, but at the same time there will be things that we can be doing loads better.
Yeah, absolutely.
And obviously you talked about that with regards to the podcast, and regards to this podcast, we can do better. So so it's an important discussion to be had, and hopefully more people will start to have those discussions with others and themselves.
Absolutely. And it's not shameful to say I can do better. It's empowering to do that, and change doesn't happen unless people do look inward and see how they can change for the better. You are changing for the better. You're not saying I'm going to make myself worse. I'm going to try and make myself better, and then everyone benefits from that.
Absolutely.
So, We will be doing that on this podcast, and we'll be doing that or trying to do that in our lives as well. But if any of that today has sounded interesting, do get Nova's book, The Good Ally. I've just bought a copy literally right now as we're recording, because that will definitely help you address that situation.
Yeah. It's a very important book and one that everyone should have a copy of.
Absolutely. Well, there you go. Thank you so much to Nova for coming on. Brilliant episode. Thank you to our listeners. Thank you to our patrons. I was going to read a random patron out. Can I do that, Giles?
Yeah,
okay?
Please do.
Samantha Beaton.
Hi, Samantha.
There you go, Samantha. I've done random ones in the past. I can't remember who I've done. So if I've done Samantha before, then hey, Samantha, you got your name read out twice. But I'm going to try and do some more over future episodes as well, because we love our patrons and we want to obviously let them know how much we love them. If you want to join our patron and get early episodes, ad-free episodes, and most weeks extra content, or obviously we're making this week available to everybody, you can sign up at patreon.com/blankpodcast, patreon.com/blankpodcast. And if you want to get hold of us on Twitter or Instagram, and let us know what you've enjoyed from any episode, our handle is the same for both. It is
at Blank Pod.
It is indeed. And that's the end of the episode. Charles, have a great week.
And you, Jim.
Get some training in for your walk.
I will.
I'm sure you are training hard for your long walk. Get some blister pads, basically. That's what
I'm definitely going to do that.
And have a good week, mate. And see you next week and our listeners on the Blank Podcast. Goodbye.
Media Podcast.